if you want to truly understand the ridiculousness of college football and college sports in general, the ACC has two teams that are currently suing the conference in order to try and leave without having to pay a ton of money. And three teams, Cal, Stanford, and SMU, who came to the conference and said, "We don't even need your money. We just want to be a part of your conference."
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. I have two companions on Sunday mornings this time of year, a cup of coffee and David Hale. David spends his Saturdays soaking in the glory and madness of college football and weaves the best of it into a Sunday morning recap for ESPN that is required reading for the college football fan. David's a staff writer for ESPN and co-hosts the show Inside Access on the ACC network. He's a Delaware guy who moved south, married a woman from Alabama, and now covers the South's most important sport from his home in Charlotte. If you love college football, you'll love this talk with David. But even if you don't love college football, you'll learn a lot about the forces underlying this crazy sport and how the 2024 season is maybe the most transformative in college football history. Here's our conversation. David Hale, I want to start with this recap column that you do that I see every Sunday morning. I guess if people stay up late enough Saturday night, they might get to see it too. You cover so much of the college football waterfront in one piece. What are the logistics of that like for you? Like, when do you start watching games? How many screens do you have on? How does it work?
So I initially started doing this column in, I want to say 2019, maybe 2018. I can't remember, but it had gone through several iterations of various writers that had been assigned to do it. And it was seen as, I think, a punishment for whoever had to do it, like whoever was at the bottom of the totem pole. My pal Edward, who sadly passed away a few years back, had been doing it before me and could not wait to get it off his plate. But he used to text me after I'd write one. He'd text me the next day with like, "Oh, this was my favorite joke." So I started sort of writing it almost like with the idea of my audience was Edward. I just wanted to make him laugh in something. And it's sort of grown and taken on a life of its own since then. But the logistics are I wake up, I imbibe as much coffee as I possibly can. I've got three TVs in my office here, plus my laptop, plus my phone. And lovely YouTube TV has the multi-view now, so I can have like eight games on at a time. Although I have found that that is really not the best way to consume. I don't have like the, I'm like a dog chasing a squirrel. I don't have the attention span to focus on like multiple things at once. So I'll try to like watch whatever I think the biggest or most interesting game is like closely, and then have a few other ones on so that in commercial breaks I can entertain myself. Though I will also add, it is amazing, and I'd love somebody to like do the math on this, how often if you're watching like the four game multi-view, all four of them are in commercial at the same time. Like it happens way more than it should.
This column is just full of pop culture references and jokes and that sort of thing. Do you have any of that stuff sort of preloaded, or does it just kind of come to you as stuff happens?
Some of it, like I have like a little email chain I email myself during the week of like, "Oh, this interesting story popped up in college football. Maybe that's something for the column." But even that's something I've only kind of started doing more recently to help prepare myself. A lot of it, you know, I say I have all these games on, but honestly, like part of what makes this work is because I've got Twitter going at the same time. And as much as this is an awful, horrible social media existence now, like I think one of the beauties of college football that is different to some extent than any other sport is there's just such an online community of people with a very darkly comic view of this world that they inherited and live in. And so I find a lot of sort of inspiration for jokes or interesting things or crazy plays or college football, like game producers are the absolute best at finding the most ridiculous human beings in the crowd and putting them on camera for some period of time. So all of these things sort of coalesce at some point. And then I covered baseball for a couple of years. And that got me very good at deadline writing. And so, that you haven't really lived until you've been like involved in like a 6-6, 16-inning game on deadline, and you've rewritten the story 7 times as the game has gone along. And so I think that skill set combined with just having grown up watching a lot of like Letterman and Saturday Night Live and stuff like that, I'm just it for some reason, as terrible as it is to like do this job of writing this column, I feel like it's somehow it's like a Slumdog Millionaire situation where my specific skill sets that I have added throughout my career have created this opportunity where I'm somehow good at this one thing.
So I want to kind of go into the like three-legged stool of the big changes in college football over the last year or two, and especially kind of all manifesting itself this year. But let's start here, and let me frame the question this way. For those folks in our audience who may not be familiar with all the stuff that's been going on, can you logically explain why the Atlantic Coast Conference, which is the main conference you are familiar with, now includes teams from Cal Berkeley and Stanford, which last I looked are much closer to the Pacific Coast than the Atlantic Coast? David, how did this happen?
I was talking to an athletics director, I don't know, maybe about 6 or 8 months ago, and I just sort of lamented, like, I think I might be really bad at my job. And he said, no, we all just work in a really stupid, illogical industry. And I think that is the bottom line on this. Like, to apply logic to much of any of this is an impossibility. But from a purely business sense, college sports has been what any normal business person would say is an incredibly, incredibly inefficient marketplace for a long, long time. Now, that inefficiency, I think for a lot of us, has been the beauty of how it works. Like, it's fun, like the regional rivalries and the fact that a place like Tuscaloosa, Alabama is basically the New York City, Manhattan of college football is great. And the fact that, Pittsburgh and West Virginia, schools that are less than an hour and a half apart, consider themselves completely culturally different and despise each other with every fiber of their being. Like, that's the beauty of it. But from a CEO's perspective, they would say, we're leaving a lot of money on the table because of all of this. And so you have these conferences that formed in some cases 100 years ago. I think all the time. So the Southeastern Conference at one point had Sewanee in it. And if Sewanee had just played the long game, they'd be cashing like $65 million checks a year to play college football. But some of those inefficiencies have worked themselves out to a point where conferences are growing, expanding, and in the Pac-12's cases, divesting. And so teams are moving all around to find more money and put themselves in a more lucrative position, particularly as it pertains to television contracts. The ACC is one of the Atlantic Coast Conference is one of those leagues that is desperately trying to find a way to make more money and to provide some stability to its long-term future, of which I would suggest no one should be particularly confident these days. And because two of their members, Clemson and Florida State, had not at the time filed lawsuits, but had pretty much like sent out like save the date invitations that we are going to file lawsuits to try and leave this league. They wanted to provide some security that if they lost members, they had a backup plan. And because the Pac-12 was being eaten alive by the Big 12 and the Big 10, there were these schools, Cal and Stanford, who said, like, well, we need somewhere to go. And this is, I mean, if you want to truly understand the ridiculousness of college football and college sports in general, the ACC has two teams that are currently suing the conference in order to try and leave without having to pay a ton of money. And three teams, Cal, Stanford, and SMU, who came to the conference and said, we don't even need your money. We just want to be a part of your conference. And so they are not even taking television revenue, or at least not a full share of television revenue, to just be a part of the ACC. So you get a good view of how, like, if you were like the CEO of, IBM, and then were given like a balance sheet for any college football program, even the good ones, you would say, this makes zero sense. And how do you people sleep at night?
Somehow just the names of the conferences have become such false advertising, right? Like the ACC has two teams on the West Coast. The Big Ten has, I believe, 18 teams now. And the Big 12 has 16 teams. It feels like Congress should get involved and just, at the very least, make them change their names to something else.
And I had a big appreciation for the Pac-12 for a little while because they were the Pac-10 for a long time. And then they added Colorado and Utah way back when, in like 2012, I think, 2011, and changed their name to the Pac-12, as one would expect. They are now still the Pac-12, technically, with two teams. They are working on adding more teams now. They added four teams from the Mountain West recently, or announced that they plan to add them, and will add some more. But no matter what they do, they have already said they are not changing the name from Pac-12. So they were the ones that had their heads on straight, and now they have been convinced to go in the opposite direction. It is, but you know, the funniest thing to all of this, and it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but also would not surprise me at all if it becomes reality at some point down the road, is people have sort of posited that these conferences will continue to grow and grow. And people have speculated on a single super league or two super leagues. And then those will create subdivisions that will be more regional. And we'll end up having in 10 years exactly where we started 30 years ago with regional conferences that are appropriately named. Just we went full circle around to get there.
I mean, this is easy to make fun of and lots of fun to make fun of. But it does have real world consequences, right? Like, this is all obviously football driven, teams, conferences, universities wanting the money, television contracts that football brings in. But if you're like the Rutgers swim team and you're having to fly to UCLA for a meet, which is a thing that's going to happen now, I mean, that's some actual consequences, right?
Yeah, and I would argue that not even the biggest consequences, because, you know, some frequent flyer miles are at least a perk to this. And it's not ideal for anybody. Tonight, on Friday the 20th, Syracuse and Stanford will play in Stanford's first ACC game. Stanford is flying from the general Palo Alto area out to Syracuse. You know, there's a ton of those Palo Alto to Syracuse direct flights. Then after the game, they will fly back to California, practice for a few days, and then fly to Clemson, because again, Clemson has a lot of direct flights from San Francisco. So, I mean, it is, and that's for the football team that is flying charter and has as many perks as possible. But there's another thing that's happening right now, because again, the absolute ridiculousness of the business of college sports, which is a legal proposed settlement in a case called House versus NCAA. Part of the settlement's outcome is that schools will be allowed to share revenue with athletes, which should seem like a very logical thing, considering these schools are bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars a year. The number that is being tossed around is somewhere between $20 and $22 million. Well, the vast majority of revenue that schools get from sports comes from football. So you might want to give a bunch of that money to your football players. Of course, there's Title IX, and no one knows how that's going to work. So you might want to split it up 50-50. Of course, you might also follow sort of the guidelines and the penalty of this case, which is going to be over $1 billion, is going to be distributed to athletes, 75-15-5-5 split between football, men's basketball, women's basketball, and I forget everybody else, basically. So you can follow that rule. But as I've talked to ADs, you know, they basically said two things. One, just pick the thing that's going to help you keep winning in football, because we're going to get sued either way. You might as well get sued and win than sued and screw your football team. But the other thing is, like, prior to a couple of years ago, there was a broad-based incentive to have a lot of good programs playing at a high level. So a school like Stanford or North Carolina or Boston College that sponsor 28, 30, 32 sports, do it with the idea that a robust broad-based athletics model is a good thing. Last year, Pittsburgh, their AD won the AD of the Year award because they were not great in football, but they had one of the great women's volleyball teams in the country. Their basketball team had a great year. Soccer, they really good broad-based programming. She was just fired last week because she was too invested in paying for all sports to support all sports and not all in on football. You know, as one AD told me the other day, we have gone from sort of the moral view of we should support all of our athletes to the extent that we can to an economic model that says you really need to put all your eggs into one basket, that basket being football. We saw during the pandemic, a lot of schools tried to cut some lesser sports, men's sports in particular, for Title IX reasons, and immediately protests rose out. Stanford was one of those schools that tried to do it. They immediately reinstated those sports after the protests, but are still being sued about that now. So I don't think you're going to see a lot of sports get cut in the aftermath of this legal decision in the House case, but I think you're going to see a lot of them get defunded to a large degree. So whereas a rowing team might have had $250,000 a year budget for their team last year, they might have a $50,000 budget for their team this year.
So I think a lot of people who follow this stuff kind of loosely are saying, did you talk about this? Well, wait a second, aren't football players already getting paid now? And they are. Can you explain how they're getting paid now and how that might change with these new rules you're talking about, and whether anybody has figured out how to make sense of it all?
Yeah. So, I mean, you could argue football players have always been getting paid.
Yes. I think that's the background, is that football players always got paid, just always under the table. Now it's above board, but it's not quite the formal way that you were talking about.
Yeah, so there was a black market. Now there is sort of a gray market. And that gray market is what's called name, image, and likeness, or NIL. The theory was, and this came about in the 2020 to 2021 era, and this was post-COVID and post-George Floyd, and there was a lot of sort of progressive push to do this. And the NCAA was losing a lot of lawsuits at the federal level. And so they said, well, we need to be more fair to our athletes. Because Tommy, if you were a student at UNC Charlotte and you were doing this podcast, or you could be paid money to do that. But if you were a football player doing a podcast, even if it wasn't about football, you could not be paid for that. So the idea was, we have to make it so that athletes are on the same level as every other student enrolled at this school. So if they want to sell their name, image, and likeness to do an endorsement or host a kids camp or sign autographs, they're allowed to do that. And you can remember a few years back, AJ Green, who was one of the greats at your school of choice, Georgia, was suspended for 4 games for signing autographs for money. So this seems like a step that is towards fairness, which I would argue unquestionably it was. What happened, because this always happens in college sports, was people said, well, now there is a loophole for us to start paying players. And so you're getting contracts that are quote unquote endorsement deals. We're paying for your likeness. We're going to give you quarterback $1.5 million a year to use your likeness to endorse a product or to come endorse some things for us or show up for an event. And I've seen some of these contracts, and literally it says you will get paid, you know, whatever, $250,000 a month over the next 6 months, and you will be required to appear at between 0 and 1 events each month. So it gives you an idea. This is not paying for an endorsement. It is paying for your performance on the field. This House settlement basically takes that same thing, which is largely being done via third parties, actual businesses, or in some cases, what's called a collective, which is sort of, it's almost like a super PAC. Right? It's not directly affiliated with the campaign, but it's in communication with the campaign at every step of the way to say what the campaign wants. Now it's going to bring it in-house. But even that, like, the schools will now be able to pay their athletes directly. But even that is being sold as the schools are licensing that player's name, image, and likeness. It's still not technically being called pay for play, because the NCAA at all costs wants to suggest that these athletes are not employees of the university. They are just regular students who we happen to also be paying a bunch of money to.
When we come back, David Hale talks about why college football should stay true to itself.
I think the more you try to make college football the NFL, the less value college football has, because I think the true value of college football for me has always been in all the ways that it is not like the NFL.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with David Hale. So let's get to the kind of what I think of as the third leg of the stool in terms of the big changes that have happened. And this one's actually getting a little closer to actual games, which is the expansion of the playoffs. So just a quick primer for those who haven't followed, there used to not be a playoff in college football. Then there, for a while, it's been kind of basically a two-team playoff, then a four-team playoff. This year, for the first time, we're going to have a 12-team playoff, which means, obviously, more TV money, more games, more chances for upsets, all those sort of things, but also more wear and tear on the players, more weeks that they have to spend away from whatever academics they are doing. Where do you come down on all this, even though it hasn't happened yet? What are your thoughts on whether this is a good thing or not?
Well, whether it's happened yet, I think, or not, does not matter, because the powers that be already are talking about let's go to 14 or 16 in a couple of years, and they haven't even seen how 12 is going to work yet. I was in favor of going a little bit more than four, just because I thought occasionally there were teams. What I don't want to see, and we saw this last year with Florida State, which finished undefeated and was not invited to the playoff because their starting quarterback got hurt. What I don't want to see is a team that wins all of its games not having a chance to prove itself in the postseason. It's unlikely that you saw that in a four-team playoff, but it certainly has happened. So I think, you know, what I wanted was a playoff where every deserving team, however you want to define that, would have a shot. Now, the flip side of that, and I think you talk to anybody around the sport and they would tell you the same thing, which is every year there are somewhere between 3 and 7 or 8 really good football teams with a genuine chance to win a national championship. Then probably another 3 to 7 or 8 teams that are good, but with a fatal flaw that will almost certainly show up over the course of more than one game. And then everybody else for the next like 40 teams is basically the same. I wonder how much expanding the playoff is just going to leave us with some really bad football games being played in December. I do worry about like what this means for, just set aside what it means for the players and their families and the coaching staffs and school and all that. Think about the fans who are now being asked to shell out for multiple extra games. And all of those extra games, except for the first one, likely involve significant travel costs as well. So, you know, they're going to be playing on neutral sites of what used to be bowl game sites, or what I guess still technically is a bowl game. It's just, you know, again, we're talking about market inefficiencies in the business model, but at a certain point, squeezing every last dime out of the people who have made the sport great, I think is problematic. And we've seen that run its course in other sports over the years too. Golf, NASCAR, I think have suffered similar fates in which, when they were sort of hitting their peak, probably tried to squeeze their core audience a bit too much, and I think felt repercussions from doing that. So, you know, my concern has always been not that some of these changes were long, long, long overdue. I think the more you try to make college football the NFL, the less value college football has. Because I think the true value of college football for me has always been in all the ways that it is not like the NFL. And so I just think like the more you make it a business and the more you squeeze the people who have made it great, and the more you sort of water down the product by creating, I think, false stakes for a postseason just to have more games on TV to make more money, I think you take away sort of the magic that makes it fun. And to sort of get back to where we started with the Saturday column, like I can make jokes and make that a fun column because college football lends itself to fun, I think, more than any other sport at any other level. And I very much worry how much that disappears in the coming years.
You mentioned Florida State, FSU, a minute ago, and I think they're at the nexus of all of this. They are trying to get out of a conference that, as you said, other schools are very willing to get into. They are taking advantage, they've taken advantage of the transfer portal, which we haven't really talked about, but is part of giving players more freedom. They've used it for sort of good and maybe ill, depending on which year you're talking about. And then last year, despite winning all their games, their quarterback gets hurt and they get screwed out of a playoff spot when the playoff was only four teams. Is there some way to describe sort of what it's been like for Florida State the last couple of years, and getting into this year, which is a whole different kind of saga?
Florida State is, in some ways, yes, the nexus of the college football universe. Not in like just the stereotypical good way. It's not the capital like Tuscaloosa is. It is the Bermuda Triangle of the college football universe. And I remember, living through the 2000 election, and there's all the craziness that happened in Florida. And then I lived in Tallahassee for a couple of years. And I was like, oh, this makes sense. Everything here is lunacy. It's a fascinating dynamic because every bit of college football, it's a little like baseball in this sense, is that history is so wrapped up into everything that happens now. Like it is, other than baseball, there is not a sport I think that people's nostalgia is so present in their current decision making. So Florida State, I will skip through the logistics of how we got to this point, but at a certain point in the early 90s, a lot of teams had operated independently of a conference. And then due to TV deregulation, they all started joining conferences. So Florida State joined the ACC in 1992 or 93, I can't remember. In any case, they went the better part of a decade without even losing an ACC football game. They dominated the ACC. And that was under Coach Bobby Bowden when they finished in the top five nationally every year, won a couple of national championships. And so Florida State fans got the notion that we are too good for this league. And that was fine when they were winning the league every year. The last 20 years have been a little more of a mixed bag. They did win a national championship in 2013, and they certainly were very, very good again last year. But that has been mixed in with a lot of bad seasons as well. And so the bad seasons, they seem to be blaming not on themselves, but on their neighbors, on the ACC, that their presence in this league is costing them the tools they need to be successful. Particularly money, and is hurting them when recruiting and all of these other things. It is very funny because this week they're playing Cal, which Cal is somehow 3-0, and nobody saw that coming. But FSU Twitter, which is sort of its own hashtag, they're the most outspoken, quickly angered, inhospitable, occasionally hilarious, largely uninformed, but very staunch in their beliefs, folks. Cal Twitter, which I didn't even know existed before this week, is hilariously tweaking them at every turn because Cal is 3-0 and Florida State is 0-3. And so they're calling it Calahassee because Cal, of course, is recalled as a very liberal university. They're saying in Florida State Stadium is Dope Campbell Stadium. They've been calling it Woke Campbell Stadium. Just trying to twist the knife some on Florida State fans, which is so hilarious. And like these fans of Florida State who normally are so reactionary and angry on Twitter have absolutely no comebacks for this. They're like, why is our team screwing us into this? So all of these things are happening at once. Plus, Florida State is suing the ACC to leave because they want more money. It is utter chaos at every possible level of college, like all of the tentacles of the things that are happening in college football, from brand awareness, NIL, transfer portal, money, TV regulations, conference realignment, all those things sort of congeal in Tallahassee. And I think it has caused people's brains to just explode there.
You got into some of the fun stuff, the trolling online and that sort of thing that happens. And we've talked a lot about the flaws in college football. Like, what's the stuff you really enjoy? Like, are there certain teams or certain players maybe this year that you find just really intriguing or just fun?
I mean, a million. Yeah. Like I remember when I was at, young and thought I wanted to be a sports writer. I remember reading Buster Olney, who's a baseball writer for forever and really good at his job. And somebody had asked him, "What's it like to cover a sport that you're a huge fan of?" And he said, "Well, I grew up being a fan of teams, but you grow out of that because you're doing it professionally." And I thought, "I'll never be me. I'll never grow out of being, diehard." But I totally have. I don't root for teams. I don't have like a lot of investment in who wins and loses by and large. But I find people and stories that I love every day. And I think one of the truly fulfilling parts of doing this job is that you get to know at least a little bit about people who you would not get to know otherwise. You get to walk in somebody's shoes for a couple of days at least, whose life you would never live on your own. I just did a story a couple of weeks ago on NC State's quarterback Grayson McCall, who's from just down the road here in Indian Trail, and he was overlooked as a recruit, ended up at Coastal Carolina, and he played on a 2020 Coastal team that like shocked the world and ended up ranked as high as I think ninth or eighth in the country. During they were the most fun team during the pandemic when nobody was having any fun, and he had this flowing mullet, and he said, "I piss teal because that's the team color." And learning about these guys and getting to know them is just so much fun. And then like my sort of arch nemesis within college football is Clemson's football coach Dabo Swinney, and we like in any given day we may hate each other or love each other, and I'm never quite sure which one it is until I talk to him and see if he's being nice to me or not. But like I find him to be like one of the most fascinating character studies there is, because he is just wholly different than almost anybody else in the sport. His backstory is he was dirt poor kid from Alabama who loved football. He walked on to the football team at Alabama, ended up getting a scholarship and playing a little bit. And Gene Stallings, the old Alabama coach, kind of took a shine to him and invited him to be a GA, and then hired him on a coaching staff. And then he got fired at Alabama and then went to go work selling commercial real estate for a little while. And then he took a chance and went to see Tommy Bowden, who was the coach at Clemson at the time, at like a speaking engagement. Said, "Boy, I'd really like to get back into coaching." And Tommy Bowden ends up hiring him. And then when Tommy Bowden's fired, lo and behold, they give the interim job to Dabo Swinney to coach Clemson for just a couple of games to end the year. And he does such a good job that they hire him full time. He had never worked as a coordinator. People thought this was lunacy. The man has gone on to win two national championships, and he's done it a completely different way than anybody else in college football, and some would say a very stupid way. So you mentioned the transfer portal earlier. Dabo hates the transfer portal, or so everybody says. There's four schools that did not take a transfer this year: Army, Navy, and Air Force, all of which require a congressman to support your bid to transfer into that school. And then Clemson, which requires an even higher law of support, which is Dabo Swinney's acceptance of you as a transfer. He's very religious and he wears his faith on his sleeve, but his background and how football saved him is so defining to his life and his psychology. And he is such a inherent optimist because of the way he has overcome so much adversity in his own life through football and education, that he just views the sport through a lens that nobody else does, I think. And trying to speak logically to him about things is impossible at times. But I also have a genuine begrudging respect for the fact that like he is absolutely true to who he is at all times. And so there's like I have been covering him for more than a decade now. And he's sort of my white whale. Like I will write a book probably one day just on like my own interpretation of who I think Dabo Swinney is. Because the beauty of it is I have thought more about who he is and how his mind works than I think he ever has, which is its own. I was trying to do a story that has not come to fruition, sort of comparing and contrasting him and Kirby Smart, the coach at Georgia. And so I had a good chat with Kirby before the season. We talked for like 20 minutes, half an hour. And I'm asking him a lot of sort of like probing questions about his thought process. And, he was an acolyte of Nick Saban who retired at the end of last year. Like, what does it mean to you to be in this position where you're the guy who's sort of in Saban's role as the face of college football now? And Kirby's just like, "Yeah, I don't think about things like that." And I was like, "Yeah, all right, maybe I have asked some questions that are probably only for me to ask and not for you to ask of yourself."
You have two daughters. Do they care at all about what you do or about college football or sports in general?
Yeah, so it's funny. I am married to a woman from Alabama, and the only reason I think that her family accepted me was that I cover college football and I can talk ball. Otherwise, I would have been a Yankee outcast within their family hierarchy. And they, of course, are all big Tide fans. My wife, Meredith, however, does not care about sports at all. And in fact, Tommy will think that me doing this show with you is the singular greatest accomplishment of my career to date, because she likes you and this show way more than she likes any sports. My girls are really sort of coming around on this. They don't understand it, but like my youngest, Willa, is 5, and she'll just come in and sit on my lap and watch football with me. And she'll ask questions, and she's basically rooting for teams based on which jersey color she likes better. But it makes me happy that she's taking a passing interest. And we'll see, perhaps somebody in my house at some point will care about what I do for a living beyond me.
All right, final thing. Your reward for making it through this podcast so far is I'm going to give you 2 minutes to extol the virtues of Wawa, which way I can
minutes?
See, as you know, here in the South, we got Sheetz, we got QT, I guess Buc-ee's in a lot of places now, but you, as I can see by looking over your shoulder behind you at your desk, you're a Wawa guy, have been ever since I met you. Tell me why.
Yeah, it is ingrained in my DNA. Like I grew up in Delaware, about 20 minutes outside of Philly, where Wawa is sort of headquartered right outside of Philadelphia. And I mean, I grew up just like you go to Wawa. People think of it as a gas station now because they almost all have gas stations. But when I grew up, none of them had gas stations. It was a deli as much as it was anything, a deli with a convenience store attached. But you have not lived until you have been relatively intoxicated at 2 a.m. and then ordered a meatball sub. And in the time it takes to go from Wawa back to your home, the cheese on the meatball sub has just melted just perfectly around the meatballs. And there is nothing better in this world. It is so great. And look, they are bringing some locations slowly into North Carolina. In fact, they're opening one in Tallahassee, which it might have been the only reason I would have considered staying in Tallahassee a little longer. But it's so great. I will say, though, my colleague Andrea Adelson and I, we do a show together on ACC Network, and we have long had we'll pick every ACC game every week, and then you know, at the end of the season, see who had the better record. And we've lately been doing bets on each season, so I won't get into the whole backer story, but we allowed folks on Twitter to select what our wager should be this year. And the winning one was the loser has to spend 24 straight hours in a Buc-ee's. And I am already 6 games back of her 3 weeks of the season. So if you've got some suggestions, or anyone listening has some suggestions on how to entertain myself in a Buc-ee's for a full day, I'm probably going to need that at some point.
First of all, just to follow up, Florida State did beat Cal on Saturday, just barely, 14-9. But Cal Twitter remains undefeated. In some ways, I feel like college football is about to ruin a rare and special thing. The money grab that led to the conference realignments and the expanded playoff has ended some longtime rivalries and diluted the importance of regular season games. As David Hale says, the sport was set up in a way that didn't make a lot of economic sense. But one of the great things about college football is that so much of it makes no sense at all. It's chaos on grass, and that makes it unpredictable and fun in a way that almost no other sport can touch. I do have some faith that the essential weirdness of college football will manage to endure. One thing that sports can do as a fan is to give you an identity. And college football is so big and sprawling that there's room for every kind of quirk and kink. In some ways, it's an American metaphor, a rainbow of personalities clashing now and then, but united in a common passion and purpose. Kind of reminds me of that old Ben Franklin line when somebody asked him what kind of government we have. He said, "A republic, if you can keep it." College football is a joy, if we can keep it. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.